So we just saw one of our favorite journalists, and favorite for many good reasons, Amy's show Democracy Now, for the last many years, has served the political and cultural community in the United States and internationally, has brought us information of similar struggles to the ones that we face from people in Nigeria, from people in East Timor, from Kosovo, from the American South, from the prison industrial complex, from Peru, from everywhere, and also one of my favorite shows that Amy ever did continues to be the Yip Harbor show. It's a treasure of journalism, of cultural, political, just lushness that is unparalleled in most journalism and radio that we hear. Amy is a treasure of ours, and she is caught up in this struggle that we have all been caught up in for the last year and a half and longer. It is a struggle to maintain Pacifica Radio as ours. It was meant to be a listener-supported, listener-sponsored, free speech radio station, and come hell or high water, that's what it's going to remain. And part of what makes Pacifica great is the addition of Amy Goodman, a woman who needs no introduction, but she's flown out here, and it is a privilege and a thrill and an honor to be able to introduce Amy to you, and again, to give you a second opportunity, and not the last opportunity for this evening, to welcome Democracy Now!'s Amy Goodman.
Thank you very much for coming out and supporting Patriot Day tonight, because it is great to see everyone. I'm just trying to stand on my feet on the West Coast, coming from New York, just having landed. It is a very tough time now, but of course you all know what tough times are now here at KPFA. I think it probably would come as no surprise to you to see this culmination of what has happened. I don't want to spend the whole evening talking about this. Probably the substance of what I'll talk about is why Democracy Now! Is at this point. And that is that in the last few days, I was handed a letter by the Pacifica management that said I'm threatened with termination. I think it's very clear-cut, exerting political pressure and trying to exert political control. You know, Democracy Now! Was the first daily election show in public broadcasting, and it really doesn't come as a big surprise that as we sort of come full circle to this next election, at times like these, the pressure is very heightened. You have a close race. It's a time when people, I think, feel that they want to control things even more. And what is shaking up the system in general more now than this sort of grassroots uprising that the two-party system is trying to contain. The main thing, I think, is don't vote. You know, they're getting by with less than half of the population voting. And what is the most threatened is getting the majority of this population out to the polls. And that's what third parties do. That's what the kind of protests in Seattle, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles do. And really, I think that's what Democracy Now! Has given voice to. And that's why it is so threatening. I don't know if it registers on the overall national political radar screen, but for people who are connected to that, who are, you know, very much a part of, I would say, Pacifica in general, who much more identified with that more establishment, with those establishment powers, don't like the voices that are being heard. I mean, I've heard it for years, and I would never do a program where I couldn't, and a team at Democracy Now! Couldn't make our own decisions about what we put on. But the pressure has always been there. I think probably as it is with any other news organization, though perhaps you don't have people pushing as hard, though in some cases you may. And so, really at this point, Democracy Now, having gone through 4 years, really coming to a turning point this summer at the Democratic and Republican conventions, where we brought together this, the largest, really, expansion of the civic audience in history, in by joining together community radio and community television. We were broadcasting on Pacifica stations, on our affiliates. We joined together with Free Speech TV and Deep Dish and Paper Tiger community television in broadcasting this to public access stations around the country, a much underused resource that is very exciting, that corporations are ready to gobble up. But like with the internet, if we use it, we can make sure we don't lose it. And that's what we were trying to do. And in addition to the public access TV stations and the community radio stations, we were broadcasting on Dish Network, on Free Speech TV's new 24-hour channel. And it was an amazing moment. And it was broadcasting Pacifica's name into millions of households. I mean, how many tune in? That's another question. But the potential is tremendous. It was enormous. I was very sorry that at the Republican convention, the entire team of Democracy Now! Pacifica management pulled our credentials after the Republican convention, at the Democratic convention, so that we couldn't, it made it much more difficult. I won't say we couldn't, but it made it much more difficult to cover the Democrats in the same way as we covered the Republicans. I mean, what are we about? We're about confronting power. It doesn't matter if they're Democrat or Republican. And I think that's probably the most threatening thing of all. I mean, getting to ask former President Bush, what does he say to those who call him a war criminal for the bombing of Iraq, Jeremy Scahill and I, we were on the floor of the Republican convention. These are precisely the kinds of questions that we have been attacked for by top management. We will forge ahead. I think that Pacifica is all of us. It is making a decision about which direction to go, and we all can weigh in. I think there's space for a lot of directions. I don't think Pacifica has to go down just one road, but they are, unfortunately, making it very clear by threatening to fire me, a letter of threatening me with termination, what road they want to go down. I mean, there are local programs on local stations around the network that do exactly the same kind of thing. In fact, that's what we grew out of. Here we are broadcasting out of WBAI, my heart and my home, and we are similar to many of the programs that we do there, but we are elevating those voices to a national forum. So we're not unique in the Pacifica radio scene of the local stations or in community radio stations around the country. But what is different is we are really giving a megaphone to those different voices that have been marginalized. Not to say an uncritical one. I mean, there's as much challenging that's going on of people, whatever part of the spectrum they're on, but at least you're hearing their voices. I mean, that's the difference, and you can make your own decision. I mean, I always say that our job is to bring out the voices of those that you don't normally get to hear, that have been excluded from the mainstream political discourse. But I do think that these voices represent the majority point of view in this country. It's just that it has been so comprehensively
left out. And so we're there bringing these voices back into that conversation to demand they open up. I mean, look what happened just in the last few days. In the last debate, what we call Debate Light, named for Budweiser Light, one of the sponsors of the Commission on Private Debates and Presidential Debates, that the networks have accepted as the forum of debate, the arbitrary bar of 15% poll and 5 national polls that a candidate has to get before they're included, carefully tailored for these two candidates, Bush and Gore and the oligarchy. I mean, there they are. You've got Dick Cheney, former head of Halliburton, the largest oil services company in the world. Of course, George Bush, who was an oil man himself, following his father's tradition. And then you have Al Gore, not as much identified for his connections to Occidental Petroleum in the mainstream. Though, interestingly enough, I've heard some Republicans starting to talk about it, but they have to be very careful because of who their man is. And that's why it doesn't become such a major issue. But here we were on Democracy Now, going to Olympia, Washington, broadcasting the protests there of more than 200 people who had taken over the Democratic Party offices. It was the campaign headquarters of Al Gore just a few weeks ago, protesting his connection to Occidental Petroleum. His family goes way back. When his father left the Senate, Al Gore Sr., he became vice president of Occidental Petroleum, close friend and protege of Armin Hammer, the founder of Occidental Petroleum. And Al Gore inherited a lot of those connections and presided over the largest sale of public, of federal land in history, something that Reagan and Bush were never able to do here in California. That was Elk Hills, and that land was sold to Occidental Petroleum. In addition, you have what's happening right now in Colombia with the UWA indigenous people, who in the past have threatened mass suicide if Occidental Petroleum drills on their land. And here is Al Gore campaigning for president. But more importantly, he does have the second most powerful position in the land. He has power right now, not just attempting to get it. And what is this country doing about one of its corporations, Occidental Petroleum, which is really Gore, I think, has something like $500,000 of stock in. That's why these people were out. And that's why when Al Gore, when the New Hampshire primary was taking place, there were people who, from right here in this area, I know Project Underground, Steve Kretzman and others, were in New Hampshire, and people were getting arrested in Al Gore's offices for his connections to Occidental Petroleum. And these are the issues that we bring up, whether they involve the Democrats or the Republicans. Yes, they're uncomfortable, and certainly we were doing that at the conventions. The conventions are an amazing moment. Now, most of the press basically abandoned them, or you see the trend toward leaving the conventions, getting longer and longer. All the decisions are made now beforehand. I mean, just a few years ago, I was at the ones where they were actually announcing that Quayle was going to be vice president at the convention, and so there was something there to laugh about. But right now, the mainstream media is saying, so what's here? What's here is a picture of American politics today. One strata, those that are in control. It is the raw anatomy of power, where you have the hundreds of corporate suites, the parties for the delegates, and who are delegates? They're politicians today, they're senators and congress members, they're city council members and state legislators, those that are really being socialized now to be a part of the system, who are going as delegates from their states, and they're hobnobbing with the corporate elite, and they're learning how the system works. And it's all laid bare. And you can walk around, and you can sneak into some parties, and you can see it on the convention floor. It is a very important time, certainly fertile ground for a reporter. Unfortunately, though we were able to do this at the Republican convention, our credentials were pulled not by the state, not by the police, but by our own organization, by Pacifica, and we are breathing that straightforward censorship. This is an issue that has to be taken on head-on, and I really think it's healthy for all of us within Pacifica. I think we have to support Pacifica fully, because Pacifica is us, and it really is something to come here tonight, just a few days after I've been threatened with termination, to the place where Pacifica began 51 years ago. And it's really heartwarming and a reminder of how we all began, whether we were born or not. Or maybe some of you were part of that original crew with Luke Hill. And you don't have to hear it again, but as you know, and you probably know the story better than I do, but is how it's been handed down is that Lou Hill and friends, he was a conscientious objector in World War II, served time in prison, and felt there had to be a media outlet that was not run by corporations who were building a drumbeat for a third world war, but by artists and journalists. Media outlet, imagine that, run by journalists and artists, who is George Gerbner, University of Pennsylvania professor, says are not the corporations who have nothing to tell and everything to sell who are raising our children. That's what Pacifica is about, bringing out fresh voices, not bombarding us with what is Bob McChesney, great media historian, estimate. I think the studies show kids see 20,000 commercials a year. 20,000 commercials a year. And that's not even including programs that are commercials in themselves. And we have to look at that. I was just coming in a cab from the airport, and the cab driver was playing NPR. So I was listening and hearing all too frequently the thank yous to the corporate sponsors. I hope that Pacifica is not going down this path. And we can make that decision together, here in this room and all over the country, that Pacifica is different. As Luke Hill saw this drumbeat building for a third world war that was generated by corporations who profit from war, the corporations that were running the media, we have to march to a different track. Remain corporate free. And that means not just not take money from companies, but, and it's hard in this very commercial culture, challenge that culture. You look at NPR and public broadcasting today. Last April, I was asked to give a Schmio Award to public broadcasting. I don't know if you know what the Schmios are, but they happen around the same time as the Clios, and they are for the best in advertising. And so Mark Crispin Miller, now at New York University, and others put together an event called the Schmios. And they asked me to give a Schmio to public broadcasting. Now, what does public broadcasting have to do with advertising? Unfortunately, everything. And as I did my research for that evening, first the research started at home. I had been sitting with my niece, Arielle, and she was watching cartoons. And I said, why don't we turn to Channel 13 and see if there's some cartoons there, because there's so many commercials. She said, we are watching Channel 13. We are watching PBS. That's in New York. I was shocked. And then seeing actually all the studies that show, I mean, you have Sesame Street that started with this very cute at the end, something like brought to you by the number 2 and the letter A, and now it's the number 2 and the letter Z for Zithromax, brought to you by Pfizer, and that's an antibiotic. And why this is so particularly dangerous is, well, it's like in when you go to countries where the state run media, you know what it's about, and you read between the lines. You know you can't just trust what you read. The danger here on this country in general, corporate media, but then particularly since people are getting more media literate and understand, you know, that you should be watching out, they're less vigilant when it comes to public broadcasting. And that's where we have to be extremely vigilant and activist and protect these public spaces. You have this joint project of Children's Television Workshop and Nickelodeon, which is called Noggin. And they do all sorts of things. Among the things they've done is go into a suburban school and give the school thousands of dollars and do exercises with the kids there once a week. They did this until there was a lot of protest about what they were doing. But this is happening all the time. Once a week, going into the school, might be once a month, and having the kids write an all-about me journal. Now, how they get in there is with the good name of Children's Television Workshop. I mean, what teacher wouldn't want, you know, them to come in and work with their kids with all of their creativity, and what could be cuter and more interesting than an all-about me journal that the kids would do. And then that all-about me journal is taken by Noggin, which is a joint project of Children's Television Workshop and Nickelodeon, and market research is done. These are very serious times. Last March, there was a conference in New York on reaching the toddler market, targeting the under twos. And who were some of the main speakers? Those that came from PBS Kids Online and Children's Television Workshop, invited to talk about how to reach the toddlers and how to do brand recognition before they can read. Now, we know that with smoking and cigarettes, that they're reaching younger and younger ages, that, you know, as there's a more public awareness, the way you have to do it is reach the kids as young as you can so that they get addicted, and then it's not a matter of public awareness or however much you know. But we're seeing this increasingly in the public arena. I remember being at an NFCB conference a few years ago, and they had someone from Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and I hadn't been quite focusing, but he was talking about, I think it was called the future, a project or plan, futures project. And one of the things they were saying is they were pushing to give money to radio stations that were forming partnerships with, that's how they put it, with local businesses or companies, and that, you know, showed a kind of maturity. And this is very alarming. And so the radio stations that don't do that, they're not going to be supported. Now, so you get private money, and then you get public money. These are things that have to be challenged, as, yes, we have more and more channels, but they're being owned by fewer and fewer corporations. You have these tremendous media mergers like we're seeing today between AOL and Time Warner. This is a time when we have to be vigilant and be the ones to raise these issues more than anyone else. We are the last independent national media network in this country, and we must fight to preserve it. I think it's a very healthy debate to have, and we should be allowed to have it and be supportive in having that discussion. These are the kind of issues that we have to take on. That's why I always say it's an awesome responsibility we have to protect these public airwaves. And people think just public radio and television are there on the public airwaves, but of course all the airwaves are public. The corporations just lease them and use them for their own gain. But we have to remember that as well. And that's what we do on Democracy Now! Every day. You know our motto, it is the exception to the rulers. And that's exactly what we are. That is our mission. It is our trademark. And it should be the trademark of every media organization. We shouldn't be the exception to the media. But the media should be the exception to the rulers. Unfortunately, you have a media elite today that is very much a part of the establishment. They go back and forth. So you have a Pete Williams who helped to design the censorship rules for the press in the Persian Gulf War, who was part of the, was a spokesperson of the Defense Department. He's now a leading correspondent on NBC. And they go back and forth, and you wonder why we get the kind of coverage we do of the bombing of Yugoslavia, of, well, going back to the bombing of Iraq, and we don't have to go back so far, when Westinghouse owns CBS and General Electric, which still owns NBC, which make most of the weapons for, most of the parts for most of the weapons in these wars. That's why we have military hardware shows, and that's why Pacifica needs to be there. Especially begun by conscientious objectors. And we have to stay with our mission. And I do believe that we, by maintaining that original mission, become increasingly relevant in the national discourse. People more and more are looking for an alternative. And that's also very threatening, that we are becoming a part of the national discourse. I mean, just 2 nights ago, 48 Hours did Laura Berenson's story. I don't know if you got to see it. I actually, unfortunately, missed it. But 48 Hours, a CBS reporter, did get in to interview her in prison, in Chirios prison in Lima, Peru. Laura Berenson is the American woman who has been held in prison in Peru for the last 5 years, sentenced by a military tribunal, including a judge, gun to her and the other prisoners' heads when the sentence was read, sentenced to life in prison for being a terrorist leader. Sentenced basically by Fujimori, the dictator in Peru, who's now fallen out of favor somehow with the United States, but that's only been recently. And so I would say, though I think others are hesitant to say this, that behind the scenes, to say the least, the U.S. government has been not been working very hard to free Laura Berenson, certainly not according to an act of Congress that said a president must do everything in their power, short of war, to bring home an American from another country who's being unjustly held. Certainly not what the United States has been doing in Laura Berenson's case. I know because I went down in March of 1999 with a human rights delegation to Peru, led by Blaise Fontaine of the Office of Americas in Los Angeles, and Reverend Lucius Walker, Pastors for Peace in New York. And we talked to reporters and editors and publishers about Laurie's case. We were going to try to see her, but we recognized it was very possible we might not. But to understand what people understand there, and certainly people in this country know even less about the case, but there, there's been pretty blanket coverage. And it's very interesting looking how the media operates. Laura Berenson, 5 years ago, was picked up when she was on a bus by the DINCOCHE, the military counterintelligence police in Peru. And she was brought to DINCOCHE offices. And there she was thrown into a cell with another woman who was shot up 5 times. They were thrown in there, just rats. There, and she basically had to keep this woman alive for day after day after day, 10 days, and then she was brought out without any warning to be presented to the media. Laurie Berenson was. Laurie had gone down to Peru, was involved with social justice issues, wanted to start doing some writing, reporting for progressive publications, and had been interviewing people. And it was then that she was picked up, and they charged her with being a leader of the MRTA. In fact, at the time, she wasn't quite sure what they were charging her with. She did not hear the charges against her. They were not laid out before her in the court. A complete system of injustice, but that's no surprise to Peruvians because they face it all the time. Thousands of Peruvians are unjustly held, like Laurie in jail there. But she was brought out to the press, and she was told to speak very loud and that there would be no microphone, and she was to speak in Spanish, and she would have less than a minute. And so she spoke very loudly, and she was carefully articulating and going as quickly as she could. and she looked very agitated, and she had just come out of this cell for 10 days trying to help this woman who looked like she was not going to make it. And she spoke and said she doesn't think it is being a terrorist to care about the poor, and said some other things. And when she was then taken away, the person repeated, got up from the government, said, you see, she said she was a terrorist, and Laura was taken away. And the only image people saw of her for the next 5 years, they knew how to carefully control the story, was to see her standing there very assertively just saying, and very agitatedly making her case within about 45 seconds, and then being taken away. She was frazzled, she was agitated, and that was clearly shown. And so when they show pictures of her, they either show the video, they have to show her talking, or they show her mouth twisted and saying, this is the woman. And so they call her the terrorista feminista. And no one knows otherwise in Peru. They say, see the, you can just see it in her face. And when I asked the publishers and editors, why do you keep using the same picture? At least use something different, since that is what really tells the story. And yet they were very careful about that. And we see this in stories over and over here. That's just particularly egregious and carefully controlled. So we went down to try to hear what Laurie had to say. And in fact, we did get into the prison, the Sacobaya prison, in Arequipa, Peru's second city. We got in. It was a fluke. Pushed very hard to get in, and we had a contact visit with her for a long time. Her parents don't have contact visits. They've seen her behind mesh and plastic and glass for a long time, for 5 years. They go down on a very regular basis to keep up her spirits, to keep contact with her, and they're the ones who fight for her freedom and convey the messages from Lori to people here in this country. So that's gone on for 5 years. And as the opposition in Peru and grassroots movement became more outspoken, and then there was an opposition candidate who threatened Fujimori, he just basically took the presidency for a third term. But you can't give it up entirely, the illusion of a democratic process. Toledo had pulled out at that point, said it wasn't fair. And so it was getting a little uncomfortable for the U.S. There was nothing they could say that they supported that looked democratic. And so they started to put serious pressure on Fujimori. And I think it was at that point that they said, that they decided to say, well, maybe this would be something they could throw to the Americans. Interestingly enough, since the American government had not, I don't think, been pushing very hard for Lori, we'll give her a new trial. We will, they declared null. They voided the sentence against her for being a terrorist leader, and now say they will put her on trial, in a civilian trial. But she's already been in jail for 5 years. Clearly, there cannot be an objective case that is presented, and her family and she is demanding that she be released right now. Interestingly enough, there's been a kind of very odd reaction to Fujimori, since he is a dictator and the press hates him and the public hates him, saying, oh, now you're caving to U.S. pressure, as you call for Laura Derenson to have a civilian trial, when in fact the U.S. behind the scenes has not been putting that pressure on the U.S. government. I met with, at the time, Ambassador Dennis Jett. You couldn't have had a more hostile person representing her case. He had never gone to visit her. He was very angry that we had gotten to see her. When I came back, I had secretly recorded that conversation that we had, and I never talked about it at the time, though, on Democracy Now! I interviewed everyone the last night we were there. We left very quickly after we saw Lori so we could get word out and not be stopped in Peru, about to reconstruct the conversation. But I was too nervous about Lori's safety to actually air that tape back in March of 1999. Though I did have it, we came back and we held news conferences. People on the West Coast who were there held them here, and in the East Coast we held it in New York, across from the United Nations. And it got a lot of coverage, and the press was there, and One of the reporters came up and informed all the different networks and said, you know, how did you get this? How did you get this? I've been trying for years. And one of the network producers said, I don't get it. I mean, how could you have just gone down and actually met with her? And I mean, we have been trying for years. And I said, well, what? How have you tried? Well, we asked the Peruvian government, could we speak to Laurie Berenson? But we didn't stop there. We asked the U.S. government. And, I mean, this is how it goes all the time, is, first of all, they're seen as different forces. And in some cases, they are. But a lot of times, they work together. Of course, I saw the same thing for years with Indonesia. I mean, you would have the Indonesian military government here in the United States, the embassy, they would put out reports of the State Department with the Indonesian government seal on. And then you would have, unfortunately, from NPR to the corporate media doing reports where you get the full spectrum on what's happening in Timor, the genocide that was happening there. You would get the Indonesian government, and then you would get the State Department. And I would repeatedly, within NPR, try to push the reporters to say, okay, now that's one side, and it's fine to hear those voices, but what about the Timorese themselves? And their response would always be, oh, that's because that's you want to hear a point of view you prefer. So no, I think it's important to hear all the points of view, but it is important when you're telling a story about a population to hear from that population, sort of basic rules of fairness. Your role in your fundraising drive is we are in ours in New York and certainly on Democracy Now! All over the country. And this is a time to play long speeches because it's what I think we all appreciate is even just the medium of a long speech, that it's not a soundbite, that it's not 5 or 6 seconds of someone saying something, even someone that you agree with, that you can hear how a person develops their thinking process. I mean, that's also what's being taken out of media, is understanding how people think. Even if it's a conclusion you agree with, when you hear it in 10 seconds, I mean, how do kids see how people arrive at conclusions? And that's what extended discourse is. And that's why it's so important to have these extended speeches. And one of the people that obviously we love to play is Noam Chomsky, who has been so excluded from the mainstream media. But I was just on a plane reading his latest book, Rogue States, a very important book that looks at U.S. policy all over the world today. And you can't get enough of it because you can't get almost any of it in the rest of the media. But when he comes out to speak, you know, he can go somewhere and in just a day the signs will be up and there'll be 1,000 people who pack a place, even at MIT where he teaches, if he's going to give a speech on a political issue. People are hungry. And it's people across the political spectrum. I mean, look at what happened with Ralph Nader. At Madison Square Garden in New York, more than 15,000 people packed that stadium last week. This is a time of modern elections and campaign ads and tremendous cynicism. More than 15,000 people packed that garden, as they called it, Nader Rocks the Garden Rally, to hear Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader, who is not a rock star, but on the political scene, he is. Because he has something different to say. And it wasn't people who had come for the rock stars who came out to support him either. It was people who were cheering wildly for an hour listening to Ralph Nader speak. And these are young people, people who are used to listen to 8 and 9 second sound bites and watching MTV and video games and all that. And there they were, screaming wildly. I mean, it really gives you hope that there is a possibility that the system can be changed in this country, that people, and this is the most important thing, have hope and faith in change. Because that's where it's going to come from, that we're not completely numbed out. And I think that is an example that shows we're not. And I know that Nader's coming again to Oakland here on Saturday night, right, for another, that's tomorrow night, for another super rally. And yet, almost no coverage in the mainstream press. The largest presidential rallies in this campaign season. And almost no coverage. I was talking to Michael Moore, the guerrilla filmmaker, the day after the Super Rally, and he was saying, you know, Jesus, it was at Madison Square Garden, it's like 8 blocks from the New York Times. He said, we tried to get the closest venue to the New York Times so that they couldn't say that, like, they couldn't even walk over. And they'll send reporters to other parts of the world, right? But when it comes to Madison Square Garden, actually, apparently there was a reporter, but the piece they had in the next day was from AP. It certainly wasn't on the front pages. There was a reporter because when one of the campaign organizers got up in the beginning of the evening and said, is the New York Times here? Is the New York Times here? Looking out this vast sea of faces of up to 20,000 people, a hand did go up from the press gallery. And they said, New York Times, meet the resistance. And there was a roar that went up Madison Square Garden. But that shows hope. And it's not just in the person of Ralph Nader. It's that people are looking for someone different. It could be someone other than Nader. It's that people believe that this system is not representing them. And this belief is becoming a reality. It is happening all over the country. In Seattle, the uprising against corporate power that has become global, tens of thousands of people there. Then in Los Angeles, in Philadelphia, then in Los Angeles, in Calgary, in Windsor, the World Petroleum Congress, and the Organization of American States meetings, and we saw it in Prague. And now just today in Seoul, South Korea, 10,000 people gathering from around the world. This is rocking the political elite. They know it's happening. I mean, President Clinton did go to Seattle. He was planning to anyway with the World Trade Organization, and he got trapped, as did Madeleine Albright and Charlene Barshefsky, the U.S. Trade Representative, in their rooms by the protesters. I mean, here you had Madeleine Albright and Charlene Barshefsky crying as well because, well, pepper spray and tear gas are equal opportunity, and they walked them into their rooms like they did, maybe not quite as strong as people who were in the direct firing range of these guns that were shooting out these chemical agents at protesters. But it didn't paralyze them in the long term because they ended up stopping the launching of the Millennium Round of Talks of the World Trade Organization. And this rally, this cry that said, this is what democracy looks like, this is what democracy looks like, was heard all over the world. And you can be sure it was heard behind those closed doors. People are saying that they are not going to accept that if the corporations lose at the most grassroots levels, maybe at city councils and state legislatures, when people take votes that and pass bills that say things like, we won't do business with a company doing business with Burma. Say, you know, that would affect Unocal, your own oil company here. That, okay, they can do it there. But we will overturn it at a supranational level by a top secret organization founded in Geneva in 1995, where you don't even know who the people are who are making these decisions. Trade bureaucrats, corporate representatives who gather behind closed doors and say, no, that's illegal. It used to be GATT illegal. That's WTO illegal. That's an obstacle to trade. And so I say, when you see what happened in Seattle, the largest export city in this country, Starbucks, Amazon.com, Microsoft, Boeing, no accident that this uprising happened there. Why the World Trade Organization chose to go there is another question, but there were obstacles to trade there as well that were imposed by the state. In fact, you know that after people started to try to protect themselves from the tear gas, and the mayor declared martial law for the first time in Seattle in 50 years. No, that isn't quite breaking the tears, but the tear gas did. They declared martial law.
The they declared martial law, and they declared it illegal to trade gas masks, to give someone a gas mask, to sell someone a gas mask, so that the protesters couldn't protect themselves, which is part of why you see everyone wearing bandanas. Everyone thinks it's so, you know, revolutionary, so Zapatista. Well, part of the real reason is that the only way they could protect themselves is to dip their bandanas in vinegar and put it against their faces to protect them, to cut the effect of the tear gas and pepper spray. And so here they were not allowed to use gas masks, and of course the military, the police, the Navy SEALs, the Army, these are all the people, the police, the state troopers, Navy SEALs, military, Army, Marines. They were all out there in force in Seattle. They had tear gas masks, and they were the ones that were shooting the tear gas. But people could not protect themselves. So, I mean, I think there's a really strong case to be brought to the World Trade Organization for a case against an obstacle to trade. You couldn't trade gas masks. But anyway, that's going to be our next gift and the next fundraising drive. Gas mask with the logo Democracy Now. I'm just going to say we need some oxygen. Right. We need to get some fresh air into the national political discourse. It is critical to have it at a local level, and we have to go much higher because the conversations you're having, people are having all over the world. Like José Bové is going to jail in the south of France, who is this Roquefort cheese farmer, who, together with others, felt the very strong effects of the U.S. Bullying their way through the world. And that was the case of the U.S. selling hormone-injected beef to European countries. And for the last 10 years, they've had a ban on it. And so the U.S. went to the World Trade Organization and said, this is an obstacle to trade. And here are countries trying to protect the public health of their people. And the U.S. was saying, no, it's just very straightforward, an obstacle to trade. And they won, and they, while the European countries did not cave, they said, if you will not accept our hormone-injected beef, then we will sanction your products. We will tariff your products, and they could choose any of the products they wanted. And so they chose, among others, Roquefort cheese, which is only made in one place in the world, in the south of France, and it would wipe out an entire region, the economy of an entire region of France. And that's where little José Bové came in. A local farmer, and with his other friends, in retaliation, they went to the local McDonald's that was just being built and started to hammer on the golden arches, and they brought some of the parts to the local prefecture and dropped them off and went home, and they were arrested and put in jail for a few weeks, and during that time, José Bové became a national hero in France, and he came to Seattle, and he was joined by farmers from India and Wisconsin, all over this country and around the world, as they demanded that the World Trade Organization be disbanded, as they demanded that this top-secret organization stop threatening the economies, the lives, the health of the people of France, of the United States, of India, and all over the world. And these conversations are now happening. The internet is very important for this. We have to get more and more people onto it so it's not a skewed discussion of only the most privileged. But we have to use the internet, and I know KPFA is now trying a cyber drive today, which is very important because it gets you using the internet. When people use it, you'll realize that it can be a real force for social change. It's limited. It's one way of communicating, but it's a part of the picture. But you want to be able to use it before it is completely taken away from us. I mean, you know that it was developed by the Department of Defense, by the military. Actually, well, by Al Gore, but then the military took it over. You know, he had private in basement things, stored in and took away his gas mask. So the military developed it, then we got it, and we got to keep it. And in order to keep it, we have to understand the value of it, and that would mean using it. But that conversation is going on the internet and people communicating around the world. That's a very good kind of globalization. It's grassroots globalization, and that is a very serious threat to corporate globalization. And this is what is bursting out all over in these uprisings that are taking place. And the media
can't help itself. It has to cover it sometimes, and the way it chooses to is when a rock is thrown or a glass is broken. And so that's why you initially got the coverage of Seattle, because of the pepper spray and the broken glass. And, of course, most of the protesters were not doing that. They didn't show the times when you have, you know, someone break into a Starbucks, a crazed yuppie trying to get their coffee. No. I don't know, because they were worrying about that. But they broke into that Starbucks, and, you know, told other people to come on in. And other protesters gathered around that Starbucks, and they locked arms, and they said, you know, we are peaceful, we are peaceful. No violence, no violence. And that was the real scene, not as much what we saw on television. But because the media is going there, you can't help but get the message. I would like to hear it in a calmer way. These people in the streets brought into the studios for a civilized conversation. That's a big difference. Between the corporate media and what we offer is they, when forced, show you pictures of thousands of people screaming. But, of course, a lot of people feel alienated from that. They say, oh, I would never do something like that. Whereas the other side, those that they're protesting that were barricaded in their hotel rooms and at the convention centers, they're invited into the studios, which is why you just have to sometimes get right into their studios, invited or not, which is what two young men from Voices in the Wilderness did just a couple weeks ago. If you're listening to Democracy Now!, you heard that story the day after it happened. In fact, I had heard, because of all the hype, that right, Al Gore and George Bush are going to be on Oprah. Each one was going to get an hour. And I missed Al Gore on Oprah, but I caught George Bush. And we had it on in the Democracy Now! Office. And at one point, as they were talking, all of a sudden you heard something like babies dying, or I don't know if I heard the word sanctions, something. And Oprah said, we're going to stop this right now and we're going to a commercial. And then she came back and said, I'm very, very sorry, Mr. Governor, George Bush, and this is the first time we've had a heckler in 15 years. And then they went on. So, but because we heard these stray words, something to do with Iraq, we go, wait a second, Oprah is in Chicago. Chicago is where Voices in the Wilderness is. Why don't we call the Voices in the Wilderness office and see who that person was? And I called up and I asked, do you know by any chance who interrupted Oprah today? And yeah, I did. And this was seen all over the country, heard all over the world. This was a very, millions of people watch the show. I just interject a little thing to set the case. You know, one of the odious work rules they have placed on me is that we have to have 3 shows set a week in advance from now on. Because they said the listeners don't believe you deal with breaking news. So I will point out that that day, I mean, it's true, we don't deal with breaking news, we just sit around much over, but that day, the next day, the only place you got to hear an extended discussion with this young man about what he had done. Now, I won't say that he didn't get any attention, because there were some pieces on the heckler that Oprah had her first heckler in 15 years. It was astounding. I mean, I said, oh my God, the Times is going to have something on this. Not a mention of what he was saying. And so on Democracy Now! That day, okay, in the future, we put it on a couple weeks. Actually, we know, you know, the guys who were involved with, well, we don't know, I mean, if it was an act of terrorism in Yemen, but we're going to have our studio in 2 weeks, because we already have our show set for next week, but in 2 weeks since we've, and we'll let you know when that happens, but they're all booked. We had these guys on, and there were 2 young men, and they told us the story of the day, which also says so much about the media. It had been advertised that these 2 presidential candidates were going to be on, and so people got tickets in advance the week before. That morning, people were getting online at like 4:30 with their tickets. and they had tickets, so they got online. And then a lot of Voices in the Wilderness folks. This is the group established by Kathy Kelly, who's nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. She didn't get it this year. Remarkable woman for a decade has been challenging sanctions in Iraq, fasting and living in Iraq and protesting and being there during the bombing and coming back and just speaking all over the country. This group has been a voice in the wilderness and has continually sent over delegations to Iraq to challenge the sanctions. And so a lot of them went over that day, and as the people were in line to go into Oprah, they gave them each a rose with a little card that explained about the sanctions against Iraq and the 5,000 kids that die there a month, is estimated by the United Nations, as a result of the sanctions. And so it was creating this whole little buzz, and a lot of the people were going into Oprah, took their roses and they put them on, and they were reading the cards and people were talking to them. The two young men who were going to actually go in, who had tickets, they were just part of the, you know, the group that was going in. So everyone walked in, and as they walked in, they had to go through a metal detector, and then people got nervous, the Oprah people, because they saw these roses, and they then announced, they got in Las Vegas, that everyone is to remove their roses. We said, that's right, no guns or roses, we go into the show. So they got in there, and he explained how the people who are, you think it's spontaneous, you know, the people who are asking questions, but they were brought into a special section of the Oprah show. They were brought in a different bus, and they were put in a different area. In fact, it's really striking. They said that as the first person got up, they read their question from a chiro. I found quite astounding, but, and maybe because of it, in these cases, these political, so-called political events are so, I'm sure that's not always the case with Oprah, but are so controlled what these ground rules are for political discourse. That's right, exactly. And that sets the model, this debate light, this so-called debate. So, because I said to him, well, why didn't you just raise your hand? You really would have gotten your question out there and everyone would have heard it clearly. He said, because I wasn't one of the chosen ones. I saw exactly how it was going, and my question was up on the chyron. And they were in a special area, so he knew. He said he had just returned from Iraq. He had just held a dying baby in his arms. And he said he just felt it was his responsibility. He was sitting right in front, and all he did is say, what about Mr. Bush? What do you think of the sanctions? And that's when Oprah interrupted. They went to a commercial, and she said, you know, you don't do this. He said, but I do feel I have to ask this question. They said, we're going to have security take you out. You wait your turn or something. He said, but well, there's clearly not going to be a turn in the show. And so, and he said to the group, and it wasn't that hostile group. He said, I feel very uncomfortable doing this. I am a nonviolent protester or a person who's been protesting. And he said, this is not the way I do things, but I don't see a space here to speak. He was taken out, and then the guy next to him stood up, and that was the second minister, and he was taken out. But this is what it takes to try to get into the national media. I mean, we saw another remarkably spontaneous moment that the administration certainly learned from. Instead of seeing this as the people saying what they had to say, the administration saw it just as a PR fiasco. And that was when they were trying to sell another series of bombings in Iraq, and the ABC team, the War Department, Albright, Berger, and Cohen, went out to Ohio State just a few years ago. They went to what they called the conservative heartland to sell the bombing of Iraq to the American people. And it was live on CNN, brought up another media issue as well, because we weren't allowed to run more than a minute or so of this whole event, because this was CNN's, even though it was a public event where it was the administration speaking to the American people, but CNN was controlling it. Now, normally, you wouldn't particularly want to run much of this, except that you had this young substitute teacher named John Strange, who managed to get up and ask a question. He got up because he wasn't included in the questioners at this huge town hall meeting. Again, it was very controlled, but because so many people were shouting and screaming and shouting no to war, that the compromise was they could get a representative to say something. So although he was wearing a suit and tie, and parents were probably saying to their kids, see, be like him, not like them, he was one of them. And he said it was very important to know what it took to get him to be able to ask that question. All of them who were screaming, it's bloody murder. And he got up and he asked Madeleine Albright, now why exactly are we choosing to bomb Iraq She talked about how he was a dictator. He says, yes, but then, and because they were violating human rights of people in the land that they were occupying. And he said, then what about going and bombing Jakarta? What about going and bombing Jerusalem? He said, I don't advocate any of these, but this is a kind of hypocrisy that I ask you, Madeleine Albright, to explain yourself. And she responded, you know, I will talk to you afterwards. I will have an extended discussion. But he was a little smarter than that. And he said, Madam Secretary, you haven't answered my question. And reporters have a lot to learn from that kind of persistence and serious questioning. But rarely do you get to see that kind of open public discourse because things are increasingly controlled. Remember a few years ago when AIDS activists took to the studios of Dan Rather and others. Remember CBS Evening News? He began, and they went on a tour, and they broke away. And when the CBS News story was very carefully orchestrated act by ACT UP, they went into the studios, and all of a sudden you saw this head bobbing saying, ACT UP, ACT UP. And then it was as Dan Rather was talking, and they faded to black, and they went to a commercial, and he was, you know, he said, it's horrible what has just happened. Right. Someone, a real person, got into the studio and actually said something about an issue that was killing so many people around the world. This is what it takes, this level of activism, because they don't have the invite. And that's really Democracy Now! What we're about. We're often not invited in, but it is very important that we go in, because so many people have to work and do the things in their daily lives. It is our responsibility with our microphones to go to where the silence is, or to where that action is, and open our microphones so that you can hear what's going on. To go to where the silence is, because the media doesn't go, for example, behind bars very often, to the more than 2 million people who occupy the prisons of this country today, to hear what they have to say. And one of the issues that we deal with a lot, and I know that KPFA you do also, we take to a national level, is the prison industrial complex and this growing movement that is joining with the anti-globalization movement, saying in the same way corporations are marginalizing large sectors of populations around the world, we have this increasingly marginalized, imprisoned population here in the United States. What's very threatening about these movements is that the prison industrial complex movement, the movement against that, is largely people of color. And you have the anti-globalization movement, which is getting more diverse, but was largely white in this country. And you have these movements coming together. Why in Washington, at the protests in April against the World Bank and the IMF, the first day, those first arrests were people not even doing civil disobedience. They were the big marchers against the prison industrial complex and supporting a new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal. They were rounded up without any warning, more than 600 of them. And that began the protests, and the next day, all of them were in jail. They really have to separate these movements. They see a real threat in them coming together in this country, not to mention people in this country in the first world coming together with people in the third world, in the developing world. They've got to stop this before it becomes a huge explosion. Now it is sort of uprisings in different places. And Democracy Now! Is giving voice to that, having discussions about it, having debates about it. If you heard our coverage from Los Angeles, you might have heard 2 days of very interesting discussion about the use of violence. And is violence a legitimate strategy? Or is property damage violence? These kinds of questions. Because when people are kept out of the mainstream discourse, there are whole spectrums of opinion within progressive movements that don't get debated. And you see someone who is supposedly representing your point of view for a second on television, they have nothing to do with your point of view. Right, you have, as someone says, you've got the Republican and someone, what's the line, someone posing as a Republican or a Democrat, or someone posing as a Democrat is really a Republican, and it's, you can't really tell the difference. But where is the true discourse? We have a lot to discuss and debate and bring a critical ear and eye to. And I think that this is a very exciting time, and what I'm looking forward to doing with Democracy Now! And the whole team and with Pacifica is moving forward, joining with community television, with public access TV, because we have to join forces. That's
where we will get marginalized, just in our own little pockets, these sort of national treasures all over the country, KPFA, KGMU in Boulder, WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, and connect. And we have to be part of that larger independent media movement, which is why Democracy Now! Broadcasts out of the IMCs, the independent media centers, both Philadelphia and Los Angeles. It was a very exciting, fertile time to learn from young people who are very much involved in the internet, things I never dreamed that you could do, and also talk to older people who've been doing video and tape recording for a long time and see all that cross-germination taking place. We are part of a movement. Pacifica is part of that movement, can decide whether to be in the center of it, providing a lot of the years of experience that people bring, with a lot of young people who feel very alienated, who want to learn how to, as Jello Biafra says, be the media. And we really have the resources and the experience. It's hard to think of that, considering, you know, we are also resource-starved, but compared to everyone else, we have a lot that we can share, which is why I was also extremely disturbed by part of the sanctions that have been placed against me. One of the threats that if I do this, I'm facing immediate termination, is that I'm going to have no volunteers working on Democracy Now!, no national programs. And this is the lifeblood of what we do in so many ways, because people come and they bring a kind of experience that they can't work full-time with us, but they have some expertise to offer. And for me, we're not just talking, there's students who want to play a part and they have something to give. There's young people who aren't students. There's older people who've done this for a long time and can offer something else. We are part of a large movement that is taking on the corporate media. And we need help. We don't have the resources to do it all ourselves. We wouldn't want to. That's what Democracy Now! And Pacifica and KPFA is all about. We're a place that is open, that works with a lot of people, and together we can break the information blockade, and we can involve a lot of people, and that's going to reach out to a lot of people. And we're talking about television, internet, radio. That is our way of looking into the future. If they all talk digital, we can too. Just like corporate globalization, grassroots globalization, that is the level we've reached, and that is what was so exciting about the IMCs, these independent media centers. It's tough, it's disorganized, but it's also organized. And we were a key part of that. And I learned a tremendous amount at both places about who's out there, what people are doing, how we can work together. There were plenty of difficulties and tension. It's not easy, everyone coming from different worlds, but that is really the hope of the future. And we're seeing these IMCs crop up in all these places where there are these uprisings, and more people are being introduced to the idea that, yes, maybe I don't have to see this global uprising against corporate power through a corporate lens. Maybe we can see it through someone who's on the ground, who's been a part of it, or who wants to view it from a fresh perspective, being outside of it and watch it and give you a different picture. This is very exciting. We all need to come together on this. These websites that are cropping up, you know, when one of these uprisings finishes in, say, Seattle, the IMC remains, and it's given over to the independent media activists of that community, recognizing that the international struggle must also be carried out in a local way, dealing with local issues of empowerment, etc. So this is the vision that we have of moving forward and making Pacifica a very relevant and vibrant part of. I mean, I think Luke Hale, the people who started Pacifica more than 50 years ago, would be very excited by this notion of what's happening all over the world. We have Jeremy Scahill in Yugoslavia doing this fantastic broadcast, one of the only foreign reporters in Yugoslavia at the time that protesters burned the parliament building and pushed Milosevic from power. Jeremy was on the steps. He described who these people were, where they were, that they were from the provinces and actually not from Belgrade proper, and what it took. You see it in every case, John Strange, it took the crazy protesters screaming and not-so-crazy protesters for him to ask his question. Said these guys were big, they were burly. I mean, who else? And some were drunk. Who else is going to run up against all these guys lined up against them with guns? So at first you say, what are these guys doing? They're out of control. But they're the ones who push through that allow the maybe more laid-back students and intellectuals who are little, you know, they've been doing this for a long time. They were in the street. They weren't quite sure what to do. And then all these guys just threw themselves through the doors. And Jeremy was right there. And he described what happened through that day, described what it was like to go home at night, that night with his wife and his baby. And they turned on RTS, and it went black. And then they just had it on in the background, and they were doing things. And all of a sudden, it came back on again. And this was the new RTS. Now, there are all sorts of issues that are now we have to look at in this new Yugoslavia that Germany is starting to talk to us about and bring the voices of, raising questions right from the beginning. Where is the opposition? Where does it stand? Is it just a U.S.-funded pro-IMF World Bank? Is that who it's going to have to feed off of because they've been so starved there? Is there some kind of intellectual framework and activism fighting for a third way in Yugoslavia? These are the kinds of questions that he's asking that other reporters are not asking. And he's sending his files, as he learned to do, through the independent media centers when he was the producer of Democracy Now! At the Democratic and Republican conventions, to us in MP3 files, something that I know that you're doing in the KPFA news and you're getting to hear. This is very exciting. And we're now able to do, with very few resources, what the networks had a monopoly on, you know, sending good quality sound because it was so expensive. But we can now do it. That's what grassroots globalization is all about. And that really is, I think, very much this image of independent media activists coming together. Really, my vision of, and I think many people's image around the country, of where Pacifica should be. And hopefully we will be, because we are Pacifica. We can decide the direction it will go. We can decide if we want to be on that exciting frontier. And I think there is a lot of energy for that. But we have to let our views be known and work to make that happen. I'm very honored to be here tonight, to come back to the place where Pacifica was born. It's an important reminder of the responsibility that we all have. I think we can work together to ensure that our Pacifica continues, breaks new ground, opens up the microphones to people in East Timor, in Nigeria, in prison, that Mumia Abu-Jamal can still be heard, whatever you think of his case, that we hear from people on death row, that we hear from people in prison who are not on death row, because this is a population that indicates a lot about where this country is going. And especially important that we deal with these public prisons while they're still public, because that is setting the model for the future, as prisons even are becoming increasingly privatized, which means human beings that are held in those prisons are becoming the property of for-profit corporations. Now, how do they make money? Well, you can cut back on food, on clothes, on resources, on education, and all those things. You're going to save money. But those are people inside who are now bereft, even more than they are just being in prison. And these are the issues that we have to deal with. We have to challenge the state. We cannot ally ourselves with the state. It is a very important reminder, because it's not so much the punishments that we face that determine the direction we go in. It's the perks that we get. It is that will determine the direction we go in. And we have to ensure that we carve out an independent course. It is easy to get recognized if you're willing to join with that establishment media, which is the establishment overall. But in order to follow through with our mission, we have to make sure we are always there challenging, being the exception to the rulers in a very serious sense, and being a model for what independent journalism can be. And there are a lot of reporters in the corporate media who are looking to us. And I think there's also a tremendous threat in that. I'm not sure what it is. We have to see this as a real opportunity. The mainstream media is listening, because we're doing it at a national level in Democracy Now! What a lot of people began their careers wanting to do. I mean, originally, years ago, journalism wasn't the place where you make money. Now, the reporters, you know, the ones, the faces on TV, they're making millions of dollars. And that's changing the nature of who wants to go into it. I mean, I think it was also true for doctors and medicine. When they became, not every country are they the elite, but in this country, when they became the elite, it changes who wants to go into medicine, because you're going into it for the money or because you want to care for people. And the same thing with the media. The more and more you see these privileged people become celebrities themselves, it changes who wants to be a part of that. But still you see those with a spark in their eye and hunger for serving society, because that's what we are, public servants. And they're in the mainstream media too. We can't reject them. And they see Pacifica as a place. And I'm getting this more and more, hearing from mainstream journalists, that they can hear those stories be broken. They can see what it is to pursue a story. What may, you may seem marginal at the beginning doing, like with East Timor, very much in the end, when it bursts on the international scene, they see there was a reason to be following us, if not the objective reason that hundreds of thousands of people were dying because our own government was providing guns to a repressive military. And just most recently, Democracy Now! Breaking the story of Tulia, Texas, where a third of the adult black population has been imprisoned because of a drug sting by a guy who was a very questionable white DEA agent who went in without any witnesses, started to arrest people, and they imprisoned it. Ultimately, somewhere up to a third of the adult black population of this town, Tulia, Texas. Now the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, 48 hours, 60 minutes, they're all in Tulia. And they were listening to Democracy Now! And it's an amazing story. Prior report on Fox, they had people on, one of the guys who was just indicted for some so-called drug offense. People who have no records were then facing sentences of getting convicted by all white juries until you're facing sentences of between a couple months and 300 years. It's an unbelievable story. And it's happening in the state of the possible next president of the United States. But in prior reporting on Fox, they're talking about Democracy Now! Breaking this story in the Texas Observer. Now, why bring that up? Well, because we do see these local stories, which are traditionally thought of as, you know, local stories, as being the heart of international issues. What we're seeing happen at a local level, because that's what Democracy Now! Is about, these grassroots stations coming together and really valuing the struggles that you engage in on a daily level in your communities as being worthy of, as being showing, as examples of what people are facing all over the world. And so we bring those struggles out, and then people all over, not only this country, because it's national, but all over the world, because it's on the internet, can hear what's happening and not reinvent the wheel. How are people dealing with this? How are people organizing? What are the forces people are up against? This is what democracy sounds like. As we said, when we razor-bladed Ralph Nader into the last debate. What do I mean? Well, no, we didn't go through, break through the police barricade in the physical sense, but there was Nader blocked out of the Boston debate, threatened with arrest. In St. Louis, he tried to get into that private debate between Gore and Bush, that joint press appearance between Gore and Bush, and the police chief said, no, we'll arrest you, you can't come in. And so we did what they couldn't do physically on the ground. We took his speeches from the past, and every time Lehrer asked a question, if you could call it that, we, or in that case it was people in the audience who asked their scripted questions, we had Gore and Bush answering, and then we inserted what Nader would say so that you could hear what democracy sounds like. I want to thank you all for coming out. Maybe we can engage in a little bit of discussion. As I now increasingly say, and really since the beginning of the program, Democracy Now! Is more than a show. It's a demand, it's a show of strength, and it's all of our strength. We can decide to protect it. I think we can move forward. I think it is a tremendous success story that Pacifica can be very, very proud of. And we can celebrate it together.
I think John Sheridan from Cape Bay's Local Advisory Board wants to present something to Ava. So I'm going to turn it over to you.
Hi, everyone. The Local Advisory Board of KBFA is in the process of trying to implement true democracy. We're holding the first ever elections by the community to elect community representatives to any local advisory board ever in the history of Pacifica. And as one of the last acts of the lame duck KPFA Local Advisory Board, I wanted to read this to Amy and present it to Amy, and I certainly apologize for the modest appearance of the package, the message and the messenger. But the Local Advisory Board of KPFA on October 11, 2000, in its capacity to review the policies of Pacifica, votes unanimously to send this sense of a local advisory board from us to the other Pacifica local advisory boards, as well as to the Pacifica National Board. We wholeheartedly commend Amy Goodman for her excellent and wonderful work on the Pacifica program, Democracy Now! Ms. Goodman's honest and courageous reporting is one of the greatest assets and expresses the truest and highest values as enunciated in the original Pacifica mission statement. We equally and wholeheartedly rebuke the Pacifica National Board and any Pacifica personnel for their cowardly actions, which in any way restrict, harass, censor, or harm Amy Goodman in the pursuit of her duties as host of Democracy Now!, abridge her labor contract, force her to cross picket lines, or otherwise abuse her and her First Amendment rights. The KPFA Local Advisory Board.